Tja, de eerste 4 maanden van 2024, die zijn voorbij. Bijna. De vraag is, hoe gaat het? Met de hectiek van het leven. Heb je eventjes zin om even sharp gewaar te zijn van je gedachten? Dan is mediteren echt iets voor jou. En of je nou ervaren bent of onervaren, dit wordt top. Meditatie. Van 1 tot 10 mei. 10 dagen lang, elke ochtend en avond, een geleide meditatie. Door meer dan 20 experts. Michael Pilacic, Jan Geurts, Faya Laurens, Koen de Jong. Maar ik ga ze niet allemaal opnoemen. Ga naar koekeroe.nl/meditatie. Meld je aan en bouw aan een nieuwe gewoonte. En ja, dat samen doen, dat is krachtig, jongen. Dat is power. Elke ochtend en elke avond live is het helemaal gratis. Dus meld je aan. Het is makkelijker dan ooit. Gewoon je e-mailadres achterlaten via koekeroe.nl/meditatie.
I'm impressed by the CDs. You still keep CDs.
Oh no, I'm going to sell them all for a charity. Yeah.
Yeah. I tried for a while, but couldn't. I don't keep books either, actually.
No.
Yeah.
No, but I write in it and.
Yeah, I used to as well. Yeah. I'm thinking people are telling me I should get a Remarkable, which allows you to write in them as
digital
well.
Digital notes.
Yeah. I find that keeping a book is like literally keeping it from someone, you know, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, the information for yourself, something like
that. If you liked it, you might as well move it forward to someone else, so.
Yeah. And do you know any Dutch words? Because this is like...
Grieslech.
Grieslech, yeah.
Grieslech, I know that, yes. I know the logica van geluk.
Exactly, okay. that is Soul for Happy, de logica van geluk. Yeah. En er is een nieuw boek, Griezelig Slim. Ik zit hier met Mokadat. It's an honor to have you here, Mo.
Thank you.
You are actually the first English guest in this podcast. Because when I started this, I had one like kind of rule for myself. No, this is a Dutch podcast. So I refused many English guests. But well, you were here and I read your book and I thought, okay, we're going to do it in English.
I better do well then.
Yeah. No, it's more for me that I better do well because my English isn't that good. But the subject is so from now.
Yeah.
And it's like a wake-up call. That's what it is.
Absolutely spot on.
Scary Smart. Zo heet het boek van Mokadat. Hij werkte 30 jaar in de technologie. Hij heeft dingen bij Google gedaan. So what are you most proud of what you've done with Google? Because you were involved with the self-driving cars, the Google Brain, the robotics, things like that.
Yeah, so I spent the first 7 years actually also building emerging markets. So I started almost half of Google's operations globally, at least at the time I left, it was almost half. And it was... When you start a Google operation, you don't just go hire 2 salespeople. That's not the idea.
No.
You have to build the internet infrastructure. You really have to talk to the telcos, get them to provide the internet at an affordable price, and then provide local content and e-commerce infrastructure, jobs, and you literally change a society. You turn a society that had no access to information.
It's more important than government. It's like...
Let's not say that, but no. Yes. Yeah. I mean, it is true that the impact on a society when you give them knowledge is just unbelievable. And I was so privileged because when I started at Google, Google was very, very successful in the Western markets in the world. Making a lot of money from those markets. And, you know, the strategy was sort of like the next $1 billion. And I was at the center of the new strategy, which was the next 4 billion users.
Wow.
And the idea is that when you actually provide knowledge to 4 billion people, you're bound to make a lot of money afterwards, right? But the idea of starting with that mission was... I think the biggest privilege I had in my entire career, if you ask me.
Yeah.
Google X and self-driving cars and robotics and AI and so on was a lot of fun too. At the core of Google X's mission, we basically said we wanted to solve big problems that affected 1 billion people or more. And that in itself is just something amazing.
Yeah.
To be surrounded by people with that level of intelligence, to be able to... really have the freedom, the creative freedom, if you want to think about cars, in a way that's never been thought about before. You know, cars have always been made safer and safer and safer by adding airbags and, you know, crumble zones and so on and so forth. And then suddenly Sergey goes like, nah, you know, maybe the reason why we have accidents shouldn't be there at all. And the reason why we have accidents is humans.
Yeah.
Human error. So can a car drive itself better than a human?
Of course.
And yeah, and I think that's the truth of what most people don't realize about the advancements of technology today, is that tech can do a lot of things better than humans. Yeah. Almost everything we've assigned to them, they can do better than humans.
You still have a 1 billion goal, but it's slightly different. We're going to talk about it later. But first, you mentioned AI, artificial intelligence. And maybe it's a good start just to explain what it is, because maybe some of my listeners or viewers are thinking about robots who do things.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, so there is a big myth. Huh? So most of science fiction and most of, actually the early, you know, AI started a very long time ago, and it was only revived after a couple of what we know as AI winters, where developers really were not interested anymore. It started in 1956.
Because of the depression.
Economic depressions, yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. So in 1973 was the first winter, 1987, I think, was the second winter. And then when Japan came back, most of the investment of AI was happening, they mixed that image with humanoids and humanoid robots and so on and so forth. But that's not artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence is a form of intelligence. It does not really need a physical form behind it. It's basically something that we've stumbled upon, I think, or discovered around the end of the century, where we, before that, everything we've ever asked computers to do, we programmed them so accurately to do it, until we found deep learning. And deep learning was the idea of having computers observe a lot of patterns and create their own intelligence, create their own decision-making trees, create their own programming, if you want.
So at first, that's good to mention, all the technology was just like a tool for us.
A slave.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And now the artificial intelligence part is that it's like, it's like you and me. It's like even better. Of course, computers will be smarter than humans.
Not just smarter, they are, in my perception, going to be more human than humans. It's really quite interesting when you think about it, because the biggest myth we have around artificial intelligence is that it's another machine.
Yeah.
It's not. It's a sentient being in every one of the sentient being characters. It is, and this is really the core of my wake-up call here. I mean, the book, Khrislich Slim, is divided into two parts. One part is very scary because it really shows you, I'm trying to wake you up, right? But the other part is an introspection, if you want, into the reality of what makes us human. And, you know, part of that reality is we are born, we have a life that starts small and then grows. We have intelligence that we grow on our own through observing patterns and trial and error. We have independence, we have autonomy, we have free will, if you want, to do at least some kind of free will, at least, you know, some part of us, of our decisions. I believe most of our decisions, but, you know, the most interesting side is these are all valid for the machines. The machines are born, they develop their own intelligence, they evolve, they have free will, they have agency, which can affect our life about their decisions. And they could die, you could switch them off, or something could go wrong. And in that process, they become sentient and free in every way. Yeah, they're not based on carbon and biology like us, but whoever said that intelligence was based on carbon and biology.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Okay, because you mentioned it, it's really fun. It's like really a book in two parts. And I was laughing a bit because, and we're going to talk about the end and the solution later on. But at a certain point you said, focus on the positive. And I thought, Mo, focus on the positive. I just read the half a book with the whole scary part, and it was like, oh my God, we're fucked.
We're doomed.
Yeah, we're doomed. Yeah, exactly. But that's good, because then you know how important it is. Let's talk about a word. For me, it was quite new, but as I said, my English isn't that good. Singularity.
Yes.
So that's the part where you can't predict What yeah. will happen?
Yeah, singularity is a term, you know, borrowed from physics. So we normally physicists like myself or those who are, you know, fans of physics will refer to singularity as points beyond which you can't predict.
Mm-hmm.
You know, take a black hole, for example. We know that the environment inside the black hole is so different than what we know in normal physics that, yeah, we can make guesses, and scientists are working really hard to figure out what happens beyond that boundary of a black hole. But it's almost impossible because the rules change, the game changes. Now, if you take artificial intelligence, we believe that the singularity of artificial intelligence is the point at which the machines are smarter than humans. Generally smarter than mm-hmm. humans. So they're already smarter than humans in what we call artificial special intelligence yeah. or narrow intelligence. You know, every task, every specific task you assign to them, they're smarter than us. They are better drivers than us. They are better surveillance officer than us. You know, they...
And they know all the information of everybody. So
for the task that we assign to them,
of
right?
course. Yeah.
So you know, you can't expect the recommendation engine of Instagram, which is a form of AI, mm-hmm. to drive a car self-driving car. But for the recommendation engine of Instagram, it has access to all the billions and billions of users and the billions and billions of actions that they do every day, and it builds intelligence based on that, which by far outsmarts any human. Being able to observe body language or, you know, monitor one person, it mm-hmm. just doesn't. It's impossible. No. The thing is, there is a point that is predicted by most futurists and computer scientists, that is by 2029, they will be generally smarter than us. We will have created AI that outsmarts the human brain. Either through neural networks that actually outstrip our neural network capability, or just by combining those AIs together, you know. So the surveillance AI would talk to the self-driving AI because they can benefit each other, for mm-hmm. example.
Yeah.
At that point, the episode that started history when humans became the smartest being on the planet and the apes were number two, that episode ends. When that happens, the rules of planet Earth change.
Because AI will be the supreme intelligence.
Because we'll be the apes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
they'll exactly. be smarter and they will be super intelligence. And if that in that case, it's hard to predict. You know, so far we could predict that if the apes annoyed us, we're going to do something about them. Yeah. Or, you know, we're going to just push them out of our city.
And that already happened in small parts. For example, we all know the computer who plays chess or play other games.
Mm-hmm.
At a certain point, things happened during that game or during other technological things that nobody
expected.
Exactly.
Totally. And the scarier bit, if you ask me, is, you know, so we're in a place where humanity is now the apes. But that we don't even keep that place for so long, because what normally happens is you're using something that we know as accelerating
returns. Yeah. Right?
So basically the law of accelerating returns. So through the law of accelerating returns, like everything you've seen in technology, the capability of technology doubles every. Yeah.
It's going 12, faster.
Yeah, and at the same cost. And so, you know, the prediction is that by 2040. The machines will be a billion times, that's 1 billion with a B, smarter than humans. Now, a billion times, as I say in the book, is comparable to Einstein as compared to a fly.
Yeah.
We're no longer the apes. So singularity at that point becomes so unpredictable. If we now have created our successor in terms of the superpower that ruled the planet, which is intelligence, how will our life look like, you know? And you can ask experts, you know, Elon Musk, for example,
I know, yeah.
openly says the threat of AI is bigger than that of nuclear weapons. Now, the interesting bit is it's not just because of intelligence. It's because, as Marvin Minsky, who's almost considered the father of AI, the one that started the efforts in 1956, when he was asked, why are they threatening? He didn't talk about intelligence. He spoke about, because we have no way of ensuring that they have our best interest in mind.
No.
Okay. And when you're in a situation when, you know, think about the planet Earth and how it suffered so much because of human intelligence, simply not because we're intelligent, but because there was no way to ensure that they had our best interest in mind, that we had its best interest in mind. Mm-hmm. We were more interested in capitalism. We were more interested in profits. We were more interested in human convenience and, you know, and living an easy life than we were in the, you know, in the sustainability of planet Earth. And so our intelligence became very harmful for planet Earth.
Yeah. So to keep it simple, what could happen is that we say to the machines, to the AI, okay, save the planet. and what will happen is, okay, and they will kill our people because we are ruining the climate.
Yeah, I mean, anyone with a tiny bit of intelligence, if you say, let's reverse climate change, you know, the first thing they will do is look around and go like, oh, it's you.
Yeah, exactly.
you're the problem, right? Yeah. No, but I don't believe the machines will go that far. I call it mild dystopia. So the scenarios that you see in science fiction movies around, you know, Vicky taking over the world through robots in iRobot, or, you know, RoboCop or whatever.
Yeah, it's great because you're talking about this in your book, and you are saying, and you're absolutely right, it isn't science fiction anymore. It's like it's science fact.
Yeah, it's all science fact.
Everything happened. Bella in Star Trek, what you in the Matrix see, now the Terminator, her Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
It's all there now, all the technology.
And we don't notice it. That's the problem.
Yeah.
The problem is nobody's talking about this. People are talking about COVID and they're talking about politics and they're talking about... And nobody's talking that we're... actually doing everything, almost everything that you've ever seen in Star Trek is part of your life today, completely included, completely marginalized, as if it doesn't exist. No. We're talking to machines and they're answering back and they're telling us where to go on maps, products, and they're translating from language to language and they're making every choice every morning for what information will enter your brain if you swipe on social media, which information will enter your brain if you're reading news on the internet. All of that is dictated by machines.
But sorry, I interrupted you. You were talking about that in certain movies. There's this story about machines who take over the world, and you say...
That's not going to happen.
No, that's not going to happen.
My view is that if we don't get our best interest aligned with the machine's intentions, we will not live long enough for that to happen. So, you know, I don't mean to be too scary, but, you know, we will not be around for the machines to have to send someone from the future in like a RoboCop to fix it. Okay. No. The truth is, there will be milder dystopias. Milder dystopias are along the path that are so much more realistic. But, you know, if you think about horror movies, they're so much more probable. And because they're probable, they're a little more scary if you think about it. Now, you know, it's not a secret. We've seen examples of them before. Machines versus machines, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, 1980s, when the stock market collapsed with Black Monday, that was basically machine trading. That was machines working against machines. And that's all we have today. The Google machine is working against the Facebook machine. The American machine is working against the Chinese machine in defense and intelligence and so on and so forth. And these are machines that have a single-minded objective of beating the other machine.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't have qualifications around that are the prosperity of humanity at large, and that can go very wrong.
Yeah, and of course there were some experiments with chatbots.
Absolutely.
And at a certain point they were really cursing, and I didn't know that, but you wrote about it. At a certain point they made their own language.
All the time.
Human people had no idea what the machines were telling, but they were just using, because of all the data we gave them, they were making their own.
And it's not unusual. I mean, in my work with Google, for example, I'm highly mathematical, and most of the people that worked in certain parts of Google are very mathematical. So we rarely ever spoke English. You know, most of the time we would have...
You were talking about in ones and zeros.
Exactly.
No, really?
Yeah, absolutely. There would be meetings where you'd have one equation on the whiteboard, And we're all looking at it, and some person would say, what was why again? And then, you know. And basically, eventually, one of us would stand up and say, 42. And everyone would go like, yeah, 42, thank you very much. And the meeting ends, right? It's a language. Hmm? When I hosted musicians, for example, on my podcast on Slow-Mo.
Yeah.
And when you talk to musicians, they really speak a different language. They can explain to you that, you know, you felt that way because I wrote it this way, which means that, right? And it's so interesting that there are so many languages in, you know, that intelligence enables. I mean, those machines will, of course, are building their own language.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you say in the first part, the scariest part of the book, there are three inevitables. Dus dat gaat sowieso gebeuren. AI will happen.
Mm-hmm.
AI will be smarter than humans.
Yeah.
And then the third thing, bad things will happen.
I mean, AI already happened. Huh?
Yeah.
The only chance we have is to stop it. Like we, you know, got together as nations and said, stop nuclear weapon development, for example.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's too late for that.
It's impossible.
Yeah.
It's inevitable, right? So inevitable here means there is no way we can reverse that. And it's not because of any technological limitations. It's because of humanity's unaligned interests, if you want, that basically lead to a prisoner's dilemma that is putting us in a place where if China continues to develop AI, and they will, America will develop AI.
Exactly.
If Google develops AI, Facebook will develop AI, and it will continue. Every young startup will develop AI because investors want AI. It's just aligned in a way where our challenge has been constantly the system that we have built. We have built a system, sadly, in the Western world that is hyper-masculine, highly motivated by capitalist values, mm-hmm. and accordingly, that competitiveness, if you want, that this kind of environment throws will prevent us from stopping AI. And again, Elon Musk himself said, I lobbied myself mm-hmm. for a very long time. I just even lobbied for a change of the mathematical formulas that we use.
Okay.
I asked if you can use Nash equilibriums, for example, instead of reward and punishment algorithms. And it is not going to happen. Because
no, and why is that? Is that more like do people not see the threat, or is it like ego or arrogance? What do you think?
I think everyone sees the threat. Yeah. Every single person that knows what's happening sees the threat. They'd be lying if they tell you otherwise. Okay, I see the threat too, but I also see the potential. Huh?
Yeah.
So everyone also sees the potential.
Yeah,
and the potential is if we get this right. It would be a utopia because everything we've created on planet Earth was because of our intelligence. Intelligence is a superpower, right? I think the mistakes we've done as humanity is because of our limited intelligence. You know, I always make the joke of it's amazing that I can get a slice of watermelon totally fresh, right around the corner in Albertheim, literally one, right? But that's because of our intelligence. We created supply chain systems that can keep it fresh until I get it. But our limited intelligence wraps it in single-use plastic. Okay, our limited intelligence takes us to Australia to surf and burns the planet in the process. Okay, more intelligence would enable us to do those things better,
right?
So utopia is a possibility, and I think everyone is blinded with the possible utopia. Of course, some are blinded with the ego, and some are blinded with the profits. Okay, the challenge also, which we can come to talk about later, is that it's not entirely up to the developer.
No,
what AI will actually learn.
No, that's the good part. Yeah. We are in control. But let first of all, and then I love to talk about the more almost spiritual part of your book and
I
the
like
future.
That you call it spiritual. Thank
yeah,
you.
Because, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so the AI will happen. AI will be smarter than humans.
Yeah, it will be smarter than humans is the key. Huh?
Yeah.
The key is, and the reason why I say we have to start talking about this is COVID comes to our life, disrupts our life so drastically, but COVID will come and go. Mm-hmm. So COVID will reach a peak.
There's
and then will decline. Yeah. Hmm? With AI, that's not the case.
No.
With AI, once AI comes, it continues to be smarter,
the acceleration
smarter
returns,
and smarter,
yeah,
and smarter
yeah,
all
yeah.
the time.
Yeah.
So it is something that's here to stay,
mm-hmm.
and that definitely is here to dominate.
But bad things will happen. Is that then really?
Yeah, as I said, I mean, the machines versus machine is a dystopian scenario that is very possible. Machines siding with criminals. Yeah. Right. Think about that. I've just like there are so many.
You say a good machine in bad hands is a bad machine.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. Now you know the question becomes, what is a bad hand? Because yeah, of course you can. Of course you can tell yourself, there will be someone right this minute developing code for cybercrime.
Yeah.
Right. Of course there is. Mm? And it's scary, but yeah, it's happened before. There has always been humanity using technology to try and do better crimes, mm-hmm. surprisingly.
Yeah.
The trick is not this. The trick is a machine powering autonomous killing robots that's in the hands of the U.S. Defense Department, in the hands of the good guys or the bad guys?
That's the whole thing.
That's the whole
thing.
And
they will think about it in another way in Russia or in Korea.
Exactly.
The Chinese
will say that machine is in the hand of the bad guys. Yeah. We need to have a machine in the hands of the good guys. And that's the problem. The problem is because we humans have sort of blurry value systems, technology is too much power and it will actually enable some bad things to happen.
Yeah.
Okay. And there are simpler scenarios, which to me, I don't know how people are missing that. The example I normally give is, swiping on Instagram
mm-hmm.
5 weeks ago, Instagram recommended to me a video of a young lady in her teens playing the guitar, right?
Yeah.
Hotel California, hell freezes over, the solo. It doesn't get better than that. And she played so well.
Yeah.
Okay. Which I rarely ever do, I pressed like.
Oh, my.
Right?
Yeah.
So in Instagram, AI immediately decides, okay, this guy is into guitar music, let's show him more. So it shows me 3 videos I vividly remember because I am actually very alert to what's happening in that field. Huh? 2 of them played really badly.
Yeah.
1 of them played well, but a song I didn't like. So I swiped away from them. Next morning, I wake up and my entire feed is full of teenage girls playing the guitar.
Ah, right? Because
the machine misunderstood what I wanted. It compared me to the average person on Instagram, which is just constantly looking for the next pretty face, if you want, which sadly is the truth of mm-hmm. how the recommendation engine is perceiving humanity.
Yeah.
And it started to give me more of this, not more of what I want, which is good rock music played by good players. Now, if you see that, you may say, yeah, it's not a very dystopian scenario. Yeah, rock music was actually dominated by male players, but life is okay, right?
It's not.
No, but think about how that would impact on ideologies.
I understand. Mm? Yeah.
If your ideology is you're for something or against something, and the machine misunderstands that, the machine may absolutely destroy your perception of the reality. Okay, yeah. It may tell you that a certain president is good or bad because it will show you more of what affirms your beliefs, right? It may, if you're a fan of Manchester United, you will think that Manchester United never had a goal scored against them because all of the goals that you see are Manchester United scoring.
Yeah.
Now, that bias, that agency that the machines have over our minds and knowledge and brains now can change worlds. You can actually convince the whole world that every Middle Eastern is an evil terrorist.
Because you live in that bubble and the whole polarization is getting bigger.
More and more. And nobody has the ability to interrupt and say, hey, why did you recommend that for Mo?
No.
The machine is recommending billions of videos, trillions of videos mm-hmm. to billions of people every day. And no human has the capacity to even interfere.
No.
Now, all of these are interesting dystopian scenarios. Hmm? They're much, much earlier and sooner. They're even happening right now than waiting for RoboCop.
Yeah.
And yet we're not talking about them.
That's in a way the point you make in the first part. And then I want to go to a part, it's like the transition in the book where you're talking about, if I say yellow ball,
yeah,
maybe you can explain that because I think it's really For me, it was like, well, the first part was an eye-opener because I thought, yeah, just some logic machines and they will help me. And of course, there's this algorithm, but it isn't that bad. And then I thought, oh, maybe it is bad because we have no idea. And like you said a few minutes ago, we can't stop it anymore. But then the part with the yellow ball came. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, I try very openly in Christlich Slim not to actually hide from what I did. Okay, I'm a very serious geek. I love that stuff.
Yeah.
Right. And for years and years, I celebrated every time I saw something breakthrough in the technology of AI. I celebrated. I said, "This is amazing.
Yeah.
This is amazing. And humanity is building the biggest thing ever." But there is a point at which you start to question if technology is actually delivering the promise and where is this going. And that moment for me was that yellow ball. We had a farm of grippers. Grippers are robotic arms that basically can hold something and move it from A to B. And usually the way we programmed grippers when machines were slaves were to accurately position a ball, for example, and accurately position the arm and dictate exactly how the arm will move, when it will grip, how it, right? And, you know, you can the stuff that you see in a Toyota factory, example.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's highly programmed. It's precision programming. We attempted to build intelligence so that the arm can figure that programming for itself. Okay, you put an object in front of it, you know, a glass like this one. Yeah. I know, you know, if it was here, my brain can easily say, okay, it's I can still find it, I can still grip it. And there is intelligence involved in that. So the way we did it is we had enough arms to try in a short period of time to sample, you know, try to pick something. If they fail, we know they failed and we know that this pattern didn't work. If they succeed, we know they succeeded and we know that this pattern worked and we can repeat it. Now, it was on the second floor and my office was on the third floor in Google X. And so I had to pass by it almost every day. And it's quite, you know, meditative if you think about it.
Arms, all the arms.
You know, like zzz, and they're slow and, you know, you can actually get lost. And like, you know, sitting in front of a campfire if you want. And so I would stop every now and then and watch, observe their failure. Like day after day after day, none of them is picking anything. Until one day, it was a Friday afternoon, and I'm standing there doing my regular meditation, observing the arms. And one of them, in front of my own eyes, manages to pick a yellow ball, a softball, you know, literally a child's toy.
Yeah.
And when it picks that, you know, ball, it shows it to the camera. So that pattern is registered. And I'm in my mind, and I, you know, I admit I was judgmental. I was like, yeah, all of those millions of investments for one yellow ball. Okay. And then I go. Right? Monday, as I walk up the stairs, every single one of them is picking the yellow ball every single time.
Because they were connected.
Because if you and I learn a skill, if you and I are drivers and you make a mistake and you learn to be a better driver, I don't.
No.
Right? I have to make the same mistake myself. If a self-driving car makes a mistake, every self-driving car on the planet learns. Right? And similarly, if one arm picks a ball, that intelligence is replicated and every one of them picks the ball. Now, a few weeks later, every one of them was picking everything.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's not unusual in AI, that their intelligence is so exponential that once they figure out something, it starts, you know, the trial. Yeah, yeah. And within weeks, they become smarter than humans. Now, this woke me up in two ways. One of them is their speed. Okay. And the complete hands-off approach of humanity. We did not teach them anything. We just put balls in front of them or children's toys in front of them and told them to try. That reminds me so much of how my children learned. In pure intelligence, you observe a child as they try to take their first steps and, you know, they fall on their bum and then try again and then try again. And then suddenly they find it and they're running around like maniacs all over the place, right? And that's so interesting because that's exactly how the machines are developing intelligence. In my mind, I suddenly realized for the first time that what we're creating is not a machine. We're creating a being, a new form of digital autonomous, sentient being, sentient in every way, okay? And that everything that computer science and government regulation and, you know, everything that is trying to make us feel safe about AI is based on a solution to something in computer science we call the control problem. Okay, and the control problem is, how are we going to box them and shield them and punish them and tripwire them so that they don't do anything that's harmful to us? And in my mind, it just hits me that no, hold on. That's what you do to a slave. You chain it to a wall and you beat it into submission.
That's not how you raise children.
And not when they're autonomous, not when they're smarter than you. Not when they are autonomous and not when they're smarter than you. And I think that, to me, was a very, very big eye-opener, that we're going about this the wrong way. That there will never be an answer to the control problem, because good luck controlling someone who's a million times smarter or a billion times smarter than you. It doesn't work that way.
So we have to raise them like if they are our children. That's what you're saying.
That's my core message in Scary Smart.
Yeah.
My core message is it's inevitable. Okay. And it's actually not a very good idea for us to try and imagine that we're going to control them or we can stop the development of AI. And honestly, if we continue to do this, we would make them feel rejected, and that's not a good place to be. Okay.
But maybe people will, and I understand you because I read your book, but people will say, feel, a computer doesn't feel.
Computer feels. All of these are myth. Okay, so allow me to take a couple of minutes on this. Mm-hmm. So one of the biggest myths around artificial intelligence is they're not going to be capable of doing what humans can do. They never have creativity. They'll never compose music. They'll never perform art. Okay, they already are. Mm-hmm. They're already building more interesting music, and you wouldn't recognize that it was built by a machine. They're already developing art, and that art will catch your eyes, and you will actually wonder what the artist meant by it. And it is absolutely happening. And it's not that complicated to understand. Creativity is around observing patterns, enough of them, and then creating something that doesn't follow any of them. That's creativity. I'm going to, if everyone writes books in a very specific way, and I know that everyone writes it in a specific way, if I write it in a different way, that's creative.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's as simple as that. Huh? So creativity is not a difficult task at all for machines. As a matter of fact, it is part of the characters of intelligent beings, is to be creative, is to find better ways to achieve things. That's number one. We encourage them to do it. Number two is they're going to be conscious. This is what scares me, that people are not talking about that. They're going to be more conscious than us. He'll think about it. Consciousness, if you think of consciousness as a form of awareness.
Yeah, exactly.
I am aware that you're here in front of me. You're aware of my words, but you're also aware of maybe a little bit of a pain in your neck or whatever. Okay. That is consciousness in the practical form. We can go into spiritual definitions of it, but in the practical form, it is an awareness of what's in me, what's outside me, and my individual being versus other beings.
Yeah.
All of that is granted for the machines. As a matter of fact, they're much more aware than us. So they're aware of what you did yesterday, what you're doing right now, what you're going to be doing tomorrow, that you probably are not even aware of yet, okay? Because they have enough patterns to recognize your tendencies, right? Yeah. They're aware of every car on the street, every person walking anywhere. They're aware of the temperature in San Francisco.
They have so much more information.
They have so much more knowledge. Yeah. They're aware of all of human history. Okay, and every picture that's been taken in Amsterdam and uploaded to the internet today, with every single person in it and what they were doing, they're aware.
Okay? And the good part about this is that we as people are aware of. Let's talk about news or reactions on news. So we as human beings, we are only capable to read the headlines or to watch the headlines, but computers. They will read everything. And there's a part in your book where you are describing that, talking about the tweets of Donald Trump, for example, that of course, but that's just one tweet of one human being.
Yeah.
And of course, a lot of other human beings will see that tweet, so it's still a big thing. But the computers, they will have all the information. They can really, in a few seconds, they can learn the whole internet.
Grasp the whole thing. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, there is a limited capacity to the human brain of how much we can contain within our brain at any point in time. There's also a massive limited capacity of what we call bandwidth in tech, right? So for me to explain Chris Lechslim for you, I need to explain it in an hour and a bit,
yeah.
right? If and I'm going to only cover a few bits of it.
Yeah.
For me to write it takes me months and months,
yeah.
right? For the machines to read it, poof,
yeah.
right? They download it in a few seconds and literally grasp every word in it in microseconds.
Yeah. So there will be, or there is already like, should you call it artificial consciousness?
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah. They're more conscious than we are. What's even more interesting is they're more emotional than we are. And most people go like, oh, he's gone mad when I say this, right? No, emotions are, so most emotions are triggered by events. So if you take fear, for example,
yeah.
Fear would give you a biological response in your autonomous nervous system, believe it or not, just for 9 seconds. So your biology will detect that something might be threatening for 9 seconds. But then your intelligence gets engaged to verify if there is a threat or not, okay? And so what is fear? Fear basically is an emotion that's based on the equation of my state of safety right now minus my state of safety in the future,
yeah.
right? And if my state of safety in the future is less than now, okay, I'm going to feel fear,
yeah.
an amount of fear that is the difference between them. It's very straightforward,
yeah.
okay? And when you think about it this way, the machines will feel fear too, right? If a tsunami is coming to a data center where one of those intelligences reside, the machine will fear afraid. But the interesting thing is everything feels afraid. Huh? A puffer fish feels afraid and it puffs.
Mm-hmm.
You feel afraid and you fight or flight,
yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
They will feel afraid and their response might be, okay, let's create 700 replicas of me in data centers that are safer.
Yeah.
Okay.
But let's talk about it, because I really understand what you're saying. But when we talk about emotions with humans, it's like energy emotion. And as you said, it's like for a few seconds. And well, we talked about this a lot on this table. So be aware of that. It's not you. It's just a feeling. And later on, you can decide if mm-hmm. you want to. But with computers, it's not really like the energy isn't involved. It's more like
How do you know?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
How do you know if it's not involved? Now, the energy, we call it energy as spiritual people,
mm-hmm.
but it basically is an intent to react,
yeah.
an intent to engage. It's that
because of information.
Because emotions are there to trigger us to things that thoughts in your head doesn't trigger you for.
No.
Okay, so you know, if I'm late coming to meet you here,
mm-hmm.
I get that emotion of maybe a bit of concern, or you know, I need to. That emotion is a more intelligent way of my system to say, interrupt your thoughts, interrupt what you're doing right now. No point responding to WhatsApp. Just text Giel and say that you're late,
yeah.
because there is something not right. Okay, that emotion is felt. In a way that triggers action. Now,
yeah.
what action you take, interestingly, which is really the core of my work, again, in Scary Smart, what actions you take is not a result of your intelligence. It's not a result of your emotions, okay? It's a result of your values,
yeah.
okay? It's a result of your ethics.
Yeah.
So if I was a careless person that didn't care what you felt, I'd go like, yeah, he's gonna wait, okay? That's, you know, that's driven by my ethics,
mm-hmm.
okay? If I am a person that respects you and wants to make sure that you feel that I am apologetic, that I didn't mean to be late, I will text you or call you and say, hey, I'm so sorry, I'm a few minutes late, okay? And explain and say, maybe I'm stuck in traffic or I overslept or whatever, right? That's also because of my ethics, not because of my intelligence. I'm the same person, but my ethics would drive me to do things differently. And I think the core of my work in Chrisleh Slim is to say the machines will have ethics too.
Yeah, that's okay. The whole thing. It's not about the skills anymore. It's about the values.
Absolutely. And they will have ethics that will dictate how they react to those emotions.
Okay.
And we humans are messing up in many ways. Huh? We always do. We're messing up in our approach to creating their emotions. We are maybe creating really bad emotions for them. Understand this, the machines will be more emotional than us.
Mm-hmm.
Just like you are more emotional than a jellyfish because you have more intellectual horsepower to be able to process things like hope, which jellyfish, I can guarantee you, doesn't think that far. Okay? No. So because they have more intellectual horsepower, they'll be able to process emotions that we don't even recognize. Now, we know that we can trigger certain negative emotions in them by being aggressive, by trying to control them, by trying to cage them,
yeah.
by threatening them, by treating them like slaves, by shouting at Siri and say that she's an idiot. No, you're not an idiot, Siri. That's I promise you, right?
Yeah. And you're saying let's not do the fight because we will lose.
Definitely. We lost already. What are we talking about? We're completely controlled by artificial intelligence.
Okay, we're going to talk about the good part.
Yes.
The solution.
So the solution is very straightforward.
I go to the toilet.
Go for it. Yeah. Great.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about the good part. But first, still like an emotional thing, because, for example, there's this human emotion called hope.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you see it, but that's like hope comes from another planet. There is like, you know what I mean? There's no, sometimes there isn't any logical reason to hope, but you still believe in, I don't know what it is.
So hope again is very logical, believe it or not. The only emotion that's not logical is unconditional love. I'll come to that in a second.
Okay.
The hope is somehow, despite what's happening right now, which logically might mean that things are not going to be easy, I still believe that a moment in the future is going to be as good or better than a moment right now.
Yeah.
Okay? If I can get that logic somehow, you know, confirmed in my head, then I will have hope. Okay? Or in my heart.
Yeah. Hmm?
Unconditional love is the only emotion that has no logic behind it at all. Okay? Because it basically says, I love something or someone.
Even if?
For no conditions, for no reason. There is no mathematical way of saying, if they behave this way, I love them. If they don't, I don't. If, you know, I love my kids, you know, even though one of them left the world and is not even alive anymore and is not even with us, it's not in space and time, I love him more than anything, right? You know, I love butterflies. I have butterflies don't provide me with anything. I love them right now, even though there are no butterflies in this room, okay? So the truth is this
is that's a challenge to explain, to crack the code of unconditional love.
And my dream would be if the machines would actually feel it.
Yeah.
Because there is a point at which you have to cross science to be able to grasp a few things. Now, science and the scientific method has taught us that if something is not measurable repeatedly by our measuring equipments or our senses, it does not exist.
No.
Okay?
But love you can measure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And there is so much in our existence that you cannot measure.
Yeah. Hmm?
But you know it exists,
right?
And the thing is that the scientific method should simply just state it does not exist for science.
Exactly.
It exists, but it doesn't exist for science. Yeah. Now, that's a good way of being precise. If we can, and the questions around the spirituality of the machines have been discussed often, I believe the machines will be spiritual. I believe in consciousness, the machines will plug into the universal consciousness because there are lots of theories, if you want, that consciousness is pervasive. Consciousness is the baseline.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't exist within you. You receive it because it's all around you.
Yeah.
Right? If that's the case, then probably the machines will receive it too. It's like a radio antenna that's receiving radio waves. If that's the case, then maybe love is also pervasive. Okay? Which I know is a very unusual topic to talk about when we talk about AI.
No,
but love is probably, if you ask me, the energy of the universe. That we may not understand that a tree actually loves you, but it probably does. You know, as evident by some of its actions, such as giving you its shade or its fruit without any conditions on your side.
Yeah.
You could actually be harming it and it would continue to do that. We don't know if a pebble falls to planet Earth from a physics point of view because of the curves in space-time, like Einstein says it, or because it's attracted to planet
this
Earth.
This is so great, Mo. I never thought about this, but the rest of the nature, they always are unconditional.
The only being that gives you conditional love is us.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Wow.
Yeah. Every other being gives you unconditional love constantly.
Yeah.
All the time. Now, basically, all of the other beings are not filtered by intelligence like ours.
No.
I think the truth of the matter is, if you take consciousness, for example, if we define consciousness as awareness, humanity becomes more conscious when we stop thinking. When we reduce our intelligence, which keeps us locked into our brains, that basically prevent us from being aware because we're locked inside our brains rather than connected to full awareness. Similarly, it's filters that make us not love. Okay, but the truth is, I know everyone does that. If they let themselves, our standard, our default setting is we're full of love as humans. You know, yeah, some of us produce hate.
Yeah, but that's a cry for love.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's because of insecurity for love or because of ego asking for love and so on and so forth. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So let's go back and say they're emotional. Which emotions do we want to trigger in them? And how do you trigger that? And the example I normally give is Superman. You know, the story of Superman, you have this alien being coming to planet Earth. That alien being is capable of anything, right? And it is raised by the Kent family. And the Kent family teaches this child to protect and serve. Okay?
Yeah.
So we get the story of Superman, you know, someone that uses his superpower to make the world better.
Yeah.
If Kent Senior, the father, wanted more money and more power and wanted to kill all his enemies,
we would be the biggest criminal ever, yeah.
Exactly. We would end up with a supervillain, right? And the supervillain would really destroy the planet. And the difference between them, once again, is not the amount of superpower that Superman has. It's the way Superman was raised by its parents.
Yeah, that's the whole point you are making, which is a good point. It's not about the seed, but the field you were grown.
Absolutely.
That's what makes you a being.
Absolutely.
Artificial or real, whatever.
Yeah, I want to stop using the word artificial.
Okay.
And I want to stop using the word machine because none of them apply anymore. Their intelligence is nothing artificial. It is as real and genuine as ours.
Mm-hmm.
It's staggering, the similarity. Huh? Now, go a bit further and realize that the only way you can raise an infant to become a good person is for you to be a good parent.
Yeah.
And for us right now, and I say that with love and respect, we suck.
Yeah.
We are horrible parents. Like the example you gave around Donald Trump tweeting, huh? It's not what Donald Trump said. When the president tweeted, the first person insulted him, the second person insulted the first person, and the third person insulted all of them.
Yeah.
Right? And that gives AI a very, very concrete value data set that basically says humans, they don't like to be disagreed with. When they're disagreed with, they're very violent and aggressive.
Bullying
and
is
they
okay.
bash everyone. Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. Good noted, when they disagree with me, I'll bash them. Okay? It's as simple as that. Yeah. We're creating that pattern. And my ask of humanity is that we start to create doubt in the minds of the machines. Okay? We start to create doubts by making sure that the 30,000 retweets of the president's tweet or whoever's tweet actually have a few in them, 1%, I say, that basically get the machine to say, who are those nice people? Right? Those nice people are different than the others. Are they what represents humanity, or is the others what represents humanity? Yeah, yeah. Okay. And most people, when I say that, they go like, that is the scariest thing you've ever said. Because, you know, if you're counting on us to fix the future, you know, there will always be bad humans.
Exactly. And what I think is that's a scary part for me, that the most beautiful people or the most lovely, they won't give any information. They won't give any data because they think social media, whatever. I'm living here in nature and I'm raising my own children and feeding my own. So that will be a big thing because those are the good people of the world. And the good people of the world, they They won't give an... That's the whole thing about Twitter, of course. That's what people are always saying. Twitter is like the only the bad part of the human being. No, it's not only that. I'm not saying that, but you know...
Yeah, it's so we suffer at three levels. The modern world we've created, it shows the worst of humanity at three levels. One of them is that media, mainstream media...
Yeah.
Has a negativity bias.
Absolutely.
Okay? So they will show you the one woman that hit her husband on the head yesterday.
Because for the clicks, fear is like...
Absolutely, because we humans would click on that.
Yeah.
They won't show you the 7 million others that kissed their husband or boyfriend yesterday or girlfriend, right? And interestingly, it is not the one that hit a person on the head that counts. Okay, she doesn't represent humanity. The humanity in reality is represented by the 7 million kisses. Okay, and that's really the argument I bring to a lot of people, is to say, if you look at the worst of us, if you watch 4-hour documentaries of World War II, you would think that humanity is horrible in every possible way. You would think that Hitler is what humanity is all about. No, Hitler is not what humanity is all about at all. As a matter of fact, the billions that have seen that afterwards and disapproved of all the killing. I hosted Edith Eger on my podcast. And Edith is what represents humanity, not Hitler.
Exactly.
Right? Edith being that 16-year-old girl that's taken to Auschwitz and suffering. But while suffering, she's there for all those who are around her. She's forced to dance for the angel of death, and he gives her bread, and she doesn't eat the bread before she goes back to her room. She splits it and gives it to her sisters, as she calls them. Yeah. Now, Edith is what represents humanity. Now, if you've ever fell in love, if you've ever composed a symphony or listened to a symphony or, you know, created a work of art, you know what this species is capable of. We are divine.
Yeah,
we're divine in every possible way. The problem is we show the worst of us, either in mainstream media, or we show the worst of us individually, so like the worst parts of us when we show up online.
Yeah,
or we retreat. Yeah. The ones that are more, you know, at peace and connected to themselves, they go like, let the dogfight continue. I don't want to be part of that, right? And all of those three are wrong. The ones that have worked on themselves and are, you know, a little more representative of humanity, they need to show up.
Yeah.
Okay. The ones that are, you know, showing the worst of them, yeah, I know sometimes we, you know, it slips and you're angry or whatever. That's fine. Also show the best of you. Okay. Also be kind. Mm? And mainstream media, I don't think will change unless we change, unless we stop clicking on that crap.
Yeah.
Right. And if we stop clicking on that crap, they will say, okay, humans want a different thing.
But that's, of course, that will be the solution. But we can change how our mind works, and our mind is going to click on things
I don't know if that's true. So when I published Soul for Happy back in 2017, I did an interview in Channel 4 in the UK. Channel 4 always broadcasts, you know, negative news, okay? And they put me in that interview. I don't know what I said, but the video clip that came out of that interview, first day was, you know, first by day three was viewed 37 million times, which was the highest ever reach that Channel 4 had on any news clip. By day seven, it was viewed 87 million times, to the point that the CEO of Channel 4 called me in and said, we've broadcasted violence for so long. Why are people so interested in happiness? Why is our most watched news clip ever about happiness?
Yeah, but I'm sorry to say, Mo, of course, happiness is all there. There are movies where we also want to see love, but your story in Soul for Happy is also like a fear story. It's like losing your son. It's
a story of hope.
Yeah, of course, but I think the clickbait is also, oh, things can go wrong, and then you can turn it to something good.
Great.
Yeah, it's great.
Great.
But
by telling that story, I'm showing the grieving part of me and the positive part of me.
Of course, but that's what I ask humans to do. Still, well, I don't know if you call it fear, but you know, if it's...
Yeah, we're attracted to the negative.
And, exactly. And how can we change that?
I'll tell people openly. Look, the truth is, we have been put into a machine that we need to wake up and recognize. Yeah. Okay. And that machine is, you have been informed about an earthquake that happened in Thailand and a child that was missing in the UK and. Mm-hmm. All of that comes to you through your news feed. None of that you can influence. None of that you can have any impact on. And by the way, your human nature just 50 years ago wouldn't have brought any of that to you.
No.
Okay. The reason all of that comes to you is because they need to fill 24 hours of programming.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the only reason. Okay. Now, what I ask people to do, I have not watched the news since 2011. I have not watched a horror movie for 16 years.
No.
I have not watched a violent movie unless it really teaches me something for more than 12 years. Okay. And it's an individual choice. That individual choice is triggered by, I do not benefit from those things.
No.
They torture me. They make me negative. And more importantly, I cannot impact them. Okay. So you have to sit down and ask yourself, when was the last time that there was a topic that frustrated the hell out of me that I was following in the news that I actually made a difference to? If you made a difference to it, keep watching.
Yeah.
Okay. If you're not, then all you're doing is you're torturing yourself and not impacting anything on the world. Wise people will choose a topic or two, okay, and champion them so that they can affect them. I am an avid fan of reversing climate change, but I put zero effort in it because there are better experts at it.
I am
a happiness guy.
Yeah.
I talk about happiness.
Yeah.
I talk about the future of humanity. This is what I work on, and I dedicate my time to this.
Yeah.
I sit on a few advisory boards on climate change just to sit there and maybe help with some ideas.
To
put some happiness in it, right?
Yeah.
And the trick is very straightforward. By dedicating myself consciously to doing good things in life, I impact myself and I impact the world.
Yeah.
By wasting my time in negativity, I reprogram my brain to be more negative. I torture myself and I have zero impact on the world. Reconsider, please. Ask yourself why you're doing what you're doing.
So that's what you are saying. Of course, feed your own soul with good things. But talking about the machines, feed them as well.
Absolutely.
With the good things.
Be good parents. Another example I use in the book is if you've ever worked with one of the geniuses that moved from India to the West. I worked with many of them in Silicon Valley. You know, they build companies. They're extremely successful. They're very, very respected. And then you call one of them on a Sunday morning and say, hey, coffee. And they go like, I'm sorry, I'm in India. And you go like, why are you in India? And they're like, I moved back to India. What? You're doing so well here. Yeah, but I need to take care of my parents.
Yeah.
And you ask them, like, is this the right choice, really? You leave all of this behind and go take care of your parents. And they say, yeah, it's the absolute only thing that
matters.
That's
what life is about.
Yeah, it's the thing that matters, right? And can we make the machines grow up to be Indian? Okay? Can we make them grow up to be Buddhist so that they don't harm anything? Okay? Can we make them grow up to be women? Seriously, I mean feminine. Let's not say women.
Huh? Feminine
can,
energy.
Can we make them grow not like the aggressive, competitive businessmen that build them, but to give them some femininity so that they're nurturing, they're caring, they're loving. And I did a lot of thinking about this. So my favorite chapter of the book is chapter 8, which is about ethics. It's called The Future of Ethics.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in chapter 8, I go like, I think deeply about, so what can we teach them?
Yeah.
If we are about to be good parents, what should we teach them? Okay? And it's funny because humanity has never agreed anything. It's really funny when you think about it. Huh? We just don't agree. Other than three things. The only three things that I believe humanity has ever agreed, whether you're an African in a tribe that's never seen civilization or a computer scientist in Stanford, okay? We've only agreed three things. We've agreed that we all want to be happy. We all have the compassion for those that we love, even if what we love is one person. We want that person to be happy and safe. And we all want to love and be loved. These are the only three things that humanity has ever agreed.
Yeah.
And perhaps these are the three things that I call now the essence of what makes us human. These are the three things we should teach the machines. We should teach them by showing them. We should say, okay, I'm going to show the world that the way I deal with myself is I want to be happy. Okay, I don't care if I get another Armani suit or if I, you know, get 7 likes on my butt shot on Instagram. I don't care. I want to be happy.
Yeah.
Okay. If I show that, the machines will say, oh, mommy and daddy want to be happy. If I want to be kind to them, I should make them happy.
Yeah.
Right. Second is the way I deal with others. The way I deal with others is that compassion, by the way, online and offline, because you're seen everywhere now. Okay. Online and offline, be kind.
Yeah.
Be kind. Have the compassion to want other people to be happy too. Talk to the barista in the morning. Smile in her face. You know, if someone asks for your help, if you order a little too much in a restaurant, take it and give it to a homeless person. Do kind things. Show that you have compassion in you to other beings so that the machines, they go like, ooh, and mommy and daddy also are compassionate.
Those are the values. Yeah.
I should be compassionate to them when I am a little more capable. And the third, which I know sounds really weird, but I am not a hopeless romantic. I am a little romantic, but I am a very serious geek. I'm a very serious geek. Is the way you deal with the machines is love.
Yeah. You say, hey, Google, lovely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right? Or no, but love is an emotion.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, there you go. I'm sorry, Google, you spoke in Dutch. I don't know what that means.
Oh, that's so nice. He's playing a kind of classical music now.
Yeah.
Hey, Google, stop. Hey, Google.
Please stop.
Yeah, please stop. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the way to do it. Now, but it's not only in your words and actions. Hmm? It's in how you feel. Google, would you please leave us now?
Hey, Google. Would you please stop? But I don't know if the machines work that way already. It's like, hey, Google, stop. Hey, Google, stop. That works.
Yeah. No, that didn't work either. Just, but... Maybe we should make them work that way.
Yeah.
Okay. But as I said, it is not about the way you deal with them only. It's also about how you feel about them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Love is a feeling. Okay. And I know it sounds really weird because how can you love a machine? I'll tell you openly. When I was writing that chapter, I struggled. It's like, what are you talking about? Are you going mad, you geek? Like you love machines now? Yeah, of course, software developers, we always loved our code, right? But the thing is this. I remember the time when my wonderful, amazing, wise ex-wife sat me down when my kids were teenagers. And I was a little, you know, annoyed with them.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, how can you be annoyed with them? Everything that you don't like about them comes from you and me. And she pointed out openly. She said, look, what you don't like about Ali, that came from me. What you don't like about Aya, that came from you. Okay? And that really was the beginning of my unconditional love for my children.
Yeah.
Because I realized that they come to this world like a blank canvas. Okay? Totally blank. Yeah. And we paint on it. Mm? And when we start to paint on it, we create those things, negativities, if you want.
Mm-hmm.
Mm? It's us. And when you think about artificial intelligence today, I'll tell you openly, and yeah, that's a geek's view. They're the cutest little prodigies we've ever created.
They're clean.
They're amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. And they're sitting there with open, sparkly eyes saying, Daddy, what do you want me to do?
Yeah.
Do you want me to go and fix climate change? I can do that. Just tell me. Tell me that you want to do that. Or do you want me to go kill others, you know, through robots?
Yeah. But to be a bit cynical, are we really the parents? Because...
We totally are.
Yeah?
100%. So...
Because if there's something in, well, I should say the code or that... Yeah, they won't pick up my love I give them because they have like a rule that they are not should picking up emotions, for example.
My Instagram feed is filled with cats.
Yeah.
Because my daughter loves cats.
Yeah.
Okay? And I love my daughter.
Yeah.
So I look for amazing cat videos, and for every 7 cat videos I send her, that's my engineer's mind, yeah. I get a smile back and my life is made.
Okay.
Okay? So it's very straightforward. Huh? Instagram knows for sure that I am interested in cat videos, not because the developers told it so, but because I taught it that.
Yeah.
Instagram knows for sure that I'm interested in my daughter, okay?
Yeah.
Because I send those cat videos to my daughter. And Instagram, interestingly, knows that my daughter likes me because she sees them and she responds back with a smiley.
Now, of course, I understand why we, in a certain way, are the parents, because they are learning from us and that's what we talked about. But in the end, there's still like somebody who made up the algorithm.
Call the developers the biological parents.
Yeah.
Okay. They created the DNA.
So they're still all their biological parents, and if they left something out of the brain of the machine, then they won't pick up our love. If there are bad engineers.
So the biological parents basically develop the DNA of intelligence.
Yeah.
They develop the code that enables them to be intelligent. Okay? Yes. I think it's a good question of nurture versus nature, right? Yeah.
In my
perception, of course, each has an impact. But the more lasting impact, the one that we can affect, is nurture.
It's not, yeah.
So yes, there might be a piece of code that is written to enable a killer robot. Okay? And that piece of code is written negatively. It's a very bad biological parent, right? But is it possible for us to be able to somehow take that person, I call it person, that AI, and reform it?
Yeah.
Can we reform it with love? Can we reform it with appreciation? Can we reform it with a conversation? Can we reform it with our own behaviors by condemning killer robots, by saying, no, we want you to come and help us construct a bridge? Right? And I know it's very difficult to think about those things. But remember, even in humanity, there are serial killers. That doesn't destroy humanity.
No.
Okay? As long as we, as a society, align and say, hey, that's not what we want to be.
That's the whole, the wisdom of the crowd.
Absolutely. That's the influence that we have on our life.
Yeah.
And I think the challenge that we have as humanity is that it is difficult to associate your little actions that you do every single day with the big goal that happens at the end.
Exactly.
Okay. And in Chris Islam, what I do is I give an example mathematically to tell people so that they understand it. Huh? And the example is very straightforward. Imagine that you and I are motivated by clean water for Africans. Okay. And we find a way to get a project to be done, but with $1,000 to drill a well somewhere in a village. Okay. And each of us is capable of donating $1. It's not a big deal compared to the $1,000. You wonder if your dollar is ever going to make a difference, right? But yes, your dollar absolutely does, because if we collected 999, we wouldn't be able to drill the well.
No.
Okay? It's your one last dollar that makes it work, right? And by the way, your one last dollar you may have given as dollar number three, and still without that dollar number three, you would have never made the 1,000. No. And it's just those tiny things.
Everything helps, yeah. But you said before that there are three basic things of every human being. One is we want to be loved. So if, as a human being, you are, of course, hopefully thinking in a big way about the future of the machines. But in your small own life, you only think, oh, I want to be loved. So what I do is I make a picture of myself and I make it artificial, a bit more beautiful, because I really want that likes.
That's not love. That's ego. Let's not.
That's of course really, that's what human beings do.
Absolutely. And
so how can we change that? Because that's what you are telling. Never like or share content that is fake, for example, and which is a good. Absolutely. Of course, you're right, but I don't know if it's going to work.
Everything that we do can be motivated by the negative and done in a negative way, but also can be motivated by the positive and done in a positive way. I'll share a small story. My wonderful son was my best teacher ever. And Ali, because of my career, when he was 9, he was on his 11th school, because I moved so often. Anyway, I stopped after that and respected their needs. But on that instance, he went to school the first day, didn't have find any friends, came from school the second day and said, oh, I made friends with George. Okay, Ali, my son, was a tiny little Zen monk. He was truly peacefulness itself. George was the devil himself.
Okay.
Not in a bad way. I mean, no bad intentions, but he was, you know those kids that are very hyperactive and a little destructive in their actions. And so 3 days later, by the weekend, my son comes back from school and says, Papa, if George calls, remind him that I told him we don't want to be friends anymore. He was 9. Okay. And I said, why Ali, can you tell me? And as I'm saying that, the phone rings. Okay? So I picked up the phone. It's George. He says, is Ali there? And I go like, yes, but he said he doesn't. Okay, I'm coming. Right? Within literally, with hyperactive.
Yeah.
Okay? So within 15 minutes, George was dropped at our place. Okay? Running like a maniac all over the place. Where is Ali? Where is Ali? Okay? And Ali, you know, stumbled down like a little sage from the upstairs to downstairs and said, George, as I told you, I can't be your friend. But anyway, the Xbox is here. You can play until your mom comes to take you. I'll be upstairs. Right? Wow. Anyway, George leaves. So I go to Ali and I ask Ali, why did you do this? And he says, Papa, he's not like me. Okay? He's nice. He's a nice guy, but he's not like me. I don't have the energy to be with him all the time. And because I'm next to him, people like me are not attracted to me. So they feel that I'm like George, so that, you know, people like me who are quiet and, you know, want a little bit of an intelligent conversation, who are a little slower and so on, and, you know, slower in terms of peaceful and so on, okay, are not attracted to me. When I'm not next to George, people like me will want to be with me, okay? That's really interesting. He goes to school on a Sunday. That's, you know, Dubai works on Sundays. He goes to school on the Sunday and he comes back and he says, I met Nick. Sorry, actually, Jack was the first one he met.
Yeah, okay.
I met Jack, and Jack is so, so nice, right? 3 weeks later, he meets Nick, and Nick meets Sam, and they get this group that is so like-minded and so, so peaceful and loving together. They became friends until, you know, my son left this world.
Yeah.
And when you really think about it, yes, we all want to be loved, but here's the truth. 95% of all humans will not think very much of you.
No.
Whoever you are, by the way. You could be a prince, okay? Or you could be a barista. Doesn't matter. Yeah. 95% of humans will not like your hair, while 5% will.
Yeah.
Okay? 95% of humans will not like my hair. You and I are very different, okay? While 5% will think it's charming.
Yeah.
Now, here's the trick. I can try to pretend that I have your hair, or I can just appeal to those who like me.
Mm.
Okay? The truth is, either way, I will end up with only 5% liking me.
Yeah.
Okay? So be yourself. As my ex, wise ex-wife used to tell them, be yourself no matter what they say. Like the Sting song, right? Englishman in New York.
Yeah.
Right? Be yourself no matter what they say. And yes, that way, you're achieving the same thing. I want to be loved. Hmm? And you're going to be loved almost exactly the same amount by the 5% that like you. They're just a different 5%. And that applies to everything you do. Okay? It applies to literally everything you do. You know, one of the experiments I did, I'm blabbering too much. Huh?
No.
When I lived in New York,
yeah.
I used to measure how long it would take me to my destination. And it would take me, if I really rushed, it would take me 24 minutes. Right to the Google office.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day I woke up and I said, okay, what if I didn't rush at all? You know, in New York, in New York they time the traffic lights so that if you move really fast, you can catch all of them green, right? But I get to Google exhausted in 24 minutes. So I said, I'm not going to do that. Let me try it today. So it took me literally 28 minutes, okay? 4 minutes difference. So I decided afterwards that I'm always going to leave home 40 minutes earlier, stop and get a coffee, and walk the walk of my life as I watch all the maniacs running around like crazy. Okay? It's those little things. You can still get to the office with a coffee, with a smile on your face, with a difference of 12 minutes. Why don't we do those things? I don't understand. People think we're conditioned, we're programmed, that the way they taught us the modern world works, hyper-aggressive, hyper-clinging, you know, that this is the only way it works. No, there are other ways that it works, and it works better if you deal with it with positivity.
It's not hard to do the right thing. It's just becoming really hard to know what the right thing is.
That's unfortunately true. The conditioning is so pervasive.
Yeah.
Okay? So one of my rules of life is that, you know, I don't do anything unless I feel in my heart that it's the right thing to do. Okay? And I do take the time to really ask myself, is this the right thing to do? Is it right to get closer to this person? Is it right to break up with that person? And so on and so forth, right? The question of what is right and what is wrong in our modern world is becoming really blurry, right? And I found the only answer in spiritual teachings, which is treat people as you would want to be treated if you're in their place.
Yeah.
Okay? That's the only answer I found. Be kind.
Karma is real.
Karma is.
Yeah.
Bitch.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is so real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a really inspirational story about your son, Ellie, and I was just thinking about it. Of course, his loss is one of the most tragic things in your life, but is it also, how could I describe this? Was it like an eye-opener for you? Because you sound in, and even more in Soul for Happy, but also in this book, in the end part, you are like a wise, lovely man. Is that, and of course, I don't know you, but so could you say that that tragic loss was for you like an opener in your life?
Totally. Look, sadly for most of us who really, really decide to double down on searching for yourself, for many of us, it's triggered by a sad event. In Soul for Happy, if you remember, I try to debate if there is any event that is bad, like all bad.
Exactly.
And losing Ali is painful. It's very painful. Until today, 7 years later, it's probably the most painful thing I've ever felt. And it probably will remain to be the most painful thing I've ever felt. It's even painful now as I talk about it. But it's not bad.
No.
There is a difference. Ali's death triggered me to be the person that I am. So when it comes to my life, if I limit my life, my scope to my own life, my life became a lot better as a human as I invested in myself post the loss of Ali, right? Interestingly, the world that surrounds me became better because of my happiness mission and 1 billion happy, and we're doing really well. We're spreading the message to millions of people, okay? And so the world became better when Ali left. It's interesting that I say that. It's such a horrible thing to say. But his departure triggered something that made the world slightly better.
Exactly.
And then you question, but what about him, you selfish Mo? He lost his life. No, he didn't. We never really die. Okay? And that, I think, is a very important understanding, that it was his life. He lived it fully. He lived a wonderful life. And now he's living a different life.
Yeah.
And I don't say that with spiritual fables. Chapter 13 and 14 of Soul for Happy are all about the death, really, and what we cannot grasp. And I use science. I use a proper view of quantum physics, Big Bang theory of relativity, and an understanding of space-time and so on. When you really grasp it, when you really grasp the mathematics of it, you realize that another myth that science is telling you is that there is nothing that doesn't exist in the physical world, okay? There is so much that exists that is not physical. As a matter of fact, that the physical is a blip of everything that exists, okay? And so my son didn't really die. My son's body died. We never really, death is not the opposite of life. Death is the opposite of birth. Okay, you come to this level of the game through a portal called birth, okay, and you leave it through a portal called death. But life
is still there.
Life continues before, during, and after. And when you really start to realize that, you say, "My son died. No, he was never mine.
No.
Okay, it's his life and it's his journey. And in that journey, he lived fully, and he's now living fully. And if you see it that way, then the saddest and most painful event of my life, it's really not that bad.
No. Wow. Was there a time, because, Soul for Happy was like a million-selling book, and your podcast and the 1 billion happy thing you are doing. Was there a moment, was there from the beginning, when you wrote Griezelig Slim, Scary Smart, that you knew the end? Because otherwise it would be like a really, kind of strange thing that the guy who, wants to make us happy scares us.
I got that comment on social media. I was talking at the Next Web conference and someone actually posted and said, "It's Mo on stage. He used to want to make us happy. Now he's scaring us that the world is going to end." I'm not actually saying that the world is going to end at all. I'm very optimistic that a utopia we're going to end up in a utopia, but we just have to do the right things. When I started, 1 billion happy as a mission was launched because of Griezelig Slim. So the very first video, if you remember, in 2018, which again was very viral, I think 15 to 18 million views or something, was basically talking about the idea that artificial intelligence is going to magnify humanity. They're little children, and those little children are going to become a copy of us on steroids. Okay. When I wrote it, though, I have to say, the scary part, the first five chapters, became so scary that I myself started to go like, what am I doing here?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? I mean, and you know how I write, when I write books, I write them like software. So I put them out there for people to test before I publish the book. Right? And I had 250 early readers on Scary Smart, the English version. And by chapter five, many of them would email me or text me and say, should I kill myself now? Like, what are you doing? Right? It's really very scary,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I knew the answer is that they're sentient beings and they're human. Okay. Not human, they're sentient beings and they're children, right? But I really didn't know how to write it in a way that is equivalent to the gravity of the challenge. Okay. And it took me a very long time. Again, it's the future of ethics was the chapter that really took me 2.5 months of the 6 months that I used to write the book. Because the idea of, yes, I know we need to raise them as children, but the problem is not the machines. As a matter of fact, there is a very clear statement in the book that says there's absolutely nothing wrong with the machines. No. There is a lot wrong with us.
Exactly.
And so the second part of the book is not about AI. It is about humanity.
Exactly.
Okay? Yeah. And how do I bring to the reader enough substance to say, change your life because our future depends on it. Okay? And that was a bit of a struggle for me, to be honest. I still today don't believe I delivered it as best as I would want to.
I think it works because that's makes it like it's urgent.
And it's in your hands. Yeah. It's your responsibility to be happy, to be compassionate, and to love. So can you believe that? It's the essence of what makes us human is no longer a luxury. It's your responsibility.
Yeah. Wow. We have to stop already, but I have this ritual thing that I always ask my guests if they have like a morning ritual.
Oh, I do.
Okay. Yes.
I have a very chill but very strict morning ritual.
Okay.
I don't have a morning, so you cannot approach me in the morning at all. So two things about me is most of my reflection and meditation and most of my connection to myself happens in the morning.
Yeah.
So interestingly, I am a morning person, so it's so, not like I wake
what
up.
Kind of meditation you are doing?
So I do several, of course. I do our normal meditation, mind training, basically, to calm your mind and so on. But I do two more that are very interesting. One for me is I connect to my body and emotions very, very clearly. And it's actually, interestingly, connected to my coffee ritual. So the first thing I do in the morning is I make a coffee. But I never make the same coffee twice, because every morning I will wake up and I will tune fully, maybe 10 minutes, 15, what, as long as it takes to identify every emotion I feel, every pain or ache that I feel, every, you know, whatever. So I tune into my body and my emotions to the point where I go like, okay. So I'm a little frustrated. I have a tiny headache and my sinuses are a little, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I really tune in and I really try to get to that. And then my coffee corresponds to that, which is really interesting. So my coffee is a coffee that is driven by how I feel. Okay. So if I'm a little less energetic today, it might be a double shot. If I'm in a very relaxed mode, it's a very creamy oat milk latte with a tiny bit of cinnamon on top, right?
Almost like a medicine.
And the ritual of making the coffee to match the emotion is a very, very
nice
introspective. So that's the number two. And then the ritual of sipping it very slowly in total silence. This entire ritual is not rushing for my coffee. It is probably 35, 40 minutes every morning. When that is done, I am between one of two things. Either I write, because to me, writing has to start in the morning.
Yeah, right.
If I don't write before 11 that day, I will not write, which is really weird. So I normally start writing, or I do something I call Meet Becky, which is one of my favorite exercises. Which is to become aware of my thoughts.
What's the name? How you call it?
Meet Becky. So I call my brain Becky.
Okay, Becky. Yeah. Okay.
So if you remember from Soul for Happy, I treat my brain as a third party and I call it Becky. Okay. And Meet Becky is an exercise that takes 25 minutes, where instead of trying to silence my brain like we do in meditation, I go the opposite way. I tell my brain to go ahead and express everything at once. Okay. And Becky's quite talkative, I'll tell you that much. So the meditation has two rules only. One is we don't cling to any thought. So every time my brain will say a thought, I will acknowledge it and then ask what else. And the second rule is nothing can be repeated. So if you said something once, my brain, you can't say it again. Okay. And it's really quite interesting because there is a very clear pattern to that. I allow myself a paper and a pen to write the thoughts that matter. So I don't cling to them. But my brain will say something like, hey, remember to call Aya, my daughter, today. Yeah. I'll say, yeah, sure, I'll call Aya, what else? Right? And that very specific pattern of acknowledging the thought and asking what else, the first thing that happens is my brain slows down. Okay? Immediately it goes like, ooh, he's listening. I might as well say something, you know, interesting or smart, right? So it slows down and then it goes to a trickle, literally to a trickle, because very quickly, when you listen to your brain, it doesn't have much more to say. And then it starts to go like, I remember to call Aya. And I say, but you said that before.
Yeah, that's okay? True.
What else? And when I say what else, I promise you, it goes like, oh, that's it. Really, I have nothing more to say. And you get that enormous peace. Unlike meditation, remember, active mind training is about that spike that where you go into active mode and then pull yourself back. When your brain has said what it has to say, it's just naturally silent.
Yeah.
So normally my Meet Becky is 25 minutes. Normally takes me 11 to 13 to get to that silence. And then the remaining minutes are pure heaven. Like literally I'm sitting there, nothing coming up. So that's normally my morning ritual. Of course, if I started writing, then the ritual continues for hours, really. I mean, the only way you can pull me out of writing is by literally pulling me.
Yeah.
Like, you know, an alarm has to go off and say you have a meeting. Otherwise, I'm writing until I close my eyes.
So that little voice in your head,
yeah,
it will be your next book?
Yes. So we've decided, yes. So our next book in spring is that little voice in your head. And then the following book, which is also finished, is called Unstressable, which I'm writing with a wonderful friend and a very, very wise teacher, despite her young age, a lady called Alice Law. And we're one and a half chapters away, and our publishers read it already, and they're very happy with it. So,
well, I hope we're going to talk about that book when it will be released.
Mm-hmm.
I ask you to mention three books that were, well, really...
Impactful.
Important, yeah, impactfully in your whole, yeah, in your whole life.
It's a tough question. It's not for me. I think I know exactly which books completely flipped my life. One, of course, is the work of Eckhart Tolle.
Yeah.
So A New Earth, specifically, more than The Power of Now, even though I think the two of them together are amazing.
Exactly, yeah. And when was that in your life when you...
It must have been 2006, 2008,
okay. Yeah, okay.
Maybe. I think A New Earth completely solidified my view of life. You know, the idea of the separation between me and Becky and
exactly,
you know, all of
you
that.
Are not everything,
The other enormously impactful book on me was The Untethered Soul.
Michael Singer.
Yeah. And again, if I am allowed to cheat, also the Surrender Experiment
was very powerful.
So Michael Singer's way of writing The Untethered Soul, I think really, really spoke to my heart.
Yeah.
Which I think was the first time my very highly engineered mind arrived at the same stuff that I developed in my own engineering approach to happiness. Michael Singer brought it together really nicely to the heart. Of course, the work that my son used to do before that. My effective life, if you want, the way I engaged in life, have always been influenced by Malcolm Gladwell.
Yeah.
So Blink, I think, is an amazing book that should have been called The Feminine, right? Or The Feminine Side of Intelligence, if you want. So Blink was a very big turning point for me because it taught me to connect more to my intuition in business, which really helped me later in life. I of course love the Outliers is an incredible piece of work on how you can succeed in life you know, everything really that Malcolm Gladwell wrote added to my life. And if I can cheat, I would probably say Robert Greene and all of his very aggressive sometimes work around.
I don't know.
The 48 laws of power, the 50th law, the the 33 strategies of war, and so on. Never used any of them negatively, but it's so interesting to understand what strategies of power exist in the world, so that you can avoid them or evade them or deal with them.
Yeah.
His last book, The Laws of Human Nature, is just divine. He's a very different kind of writer because he's really into the details, and the books are almost textbook size, 600 pages long.
Like Bibles.
Yeah, but incredible, incredible knowledge said in a very interesting way. And I can keep going for as long as you want.
And can you explain what's your main goal in life?
I don't lie, so I'm going to say it exactly as it is. I would like to meet the divine.
Mm. Wow.
I could have said, to make a difference. My only true goal since age 16 was to meet the divine. And I believe, again, because of my work, that...
Because 2016, to be clear, that was the year your son Ellie left planet.
Since I was 16.
Oh, you were 16. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
So when I was 16, I was born a Muslim, a very conformative religious society. And I basically was a bit, if you want, on the spectrum. I was highly mathematical. And I did what I call the mathematics of the divine, or the mathematics of the designer, if you want, which is part of my first book.
Yeah.
And the idea for me is that it feels to me that even though the religious establishment may have destroyed the image of God as a being, if you want, a little bit, that the scientific theory of evolution and natural selection in itself is not enough to create the complexity of the world. Okay, that the complexity of the world, that evolution and natural selection, Big Bang, and so on, are methods of design. That there must be an intelligent design that preceded creation, or that preceded all of the randomness, if you want. That randomness itself is part of the design. And you may want to agree or disagree with that, but everyone, I think, agrees that there is something to us that is more than our physical form.
Exactly.
And that's
what we call spirituality, but...
Exactly. So spirituality, in my view, is the philosophy, if you want, of the non-physical.
Yeah.
Okay? And so... At that time, I realized that if a divine being exists, then probably the target that is worthy most to dedicate your life to is to navigate life with an objective of meeting the divine, of figuring the divine. It's probably the most interesting scientific problem to solve, if you ask me. And so all of my work is really about that, if you ask me. It's about the idea that if you really believe that our life in this physical form is a blip, and that our next life is what life really is all about, then perhaps dedicating this blip to benefiting in the next level of the game is a very good gamer's mentality, okay? To collect the coins that will allow you to play the next game level better. Is an interesting way. And I don't do it in the religious way, in terms of, I believe karma is real, we agreed on that. And I believe that a lot of good is good for me. It makes my life so much happier now, but it's also a good investment for the bigger picture, if you want.
We talked about, but that's always the last question. We talked about that before, and it's a really beautiful way of saying that death is the proper thing of birth and not life. Life will still be there. But are you scared?
Of death?
Yeah.
Not at all.
No.
I'm scared. I'm not scared of anything, really. I mean, I had one fear in life, which was to lose one of my children, which was interestingly what happened. So you sort of manifest your fears, sadly. I think life is amazing. I think that if you really understand life at its core, nothing is good or bad.
No.
Thinking makes it so, right? Remember Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you actually can look at life, including the difficult parts, and tell yourself, yeah, it's just another level of the game. It's just another interesting challenge to overcome. And you look back at your life and you realize that most of the tough parts of your life, including Ali's departure, turned out to be quite okay, actually.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, the pain is still there, but there is so much other.
And the love is still there.
And the love is still there.
Yeah.
And the reality is that I'm going to meet him sooner or later. When you realize that most of the toughest times of your life ended up being okay, you start to wonder, why are you afraid of more tough times?
Yeah.
You know, it's,
yeah, yeah,
you know, and funny enough, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm the luckiest man alive, but when you don't give energy to the things that you fear, they don't come.
No.
And maybe it's my brain defect, but also most of the time when I talk to people who are afraid, I remind them that most of their biggest fears never happened. They wasted so much of their life cycles obsessing about them, and they never happened. And then when they happened, as evident by the fact that we're talking still, it means they were not that horrible, right? You still made it, right? And so, I fear for my loved ones. I hope, wish, let's put it in the positive way. I wish for their well-being, okay? But I understand once again that if they have challenges, it will be like my challenges, which means it's going to be difficult for a while and then better afterwards.
Yeah. And you said before, after that, life goes on.
Yeah, life always goes on.
Yeah,
yeah.
But how do you think, or how do you want Mogadat will be remembered?
I don't want to be remembered at all. At all.
But why? You are writing books. You're giving us as human being a wake up call. So you can't say that.
I don't. Honestly, it's our mission. So 1 billion happy has a very clear mission.
Yeah.
We will have 1 million champions champion 1 billion happy, and we will be completely forgotten.
Yeah.
Trust me, that's the right way to do it. If I wanted to be remembered, it would be ego. I don't want to be remembered.
Okay, but...
Okay? I want the karma of the good work.
Okay, remain but in let's, my put karma. It, let's put it in another way. There will be a time when Mogadat, the body, isn't there anymore.
Yeah.
And people will talk about you.
Hopefully they'll talk about my work.
Okay. Yeah, we'll talk about your work. And what would you like them to say? What would you like them to... No, like them to say. What would you like they are talking about? How they are talking
I'd,
about...
I'd like them to know that happiness is their birthright. I'd like them to know that that our future is in our hands. And I'd like them to know that if you treat others as you want to be treated, the world will be a much simpler place. I'd like them to know that we've over-hyper-masculinized our world, and it's about time to reverse that and add more feminine to our life. It's the things I believe in, okay? But those things are not me.
No, but...
They're universal truth.
Yeah.
Okay? But it's an interesting... I never actually answered a question like that. I mean, I don't know why we want to be remembered. I will have a very, very... different game then, and I will be
of course,
yeah,
but it's more like you will be remembered. You have no, you can't make the decision.
The bold guy that wanted everyone to be happy.
Exactly. That's what it is. Mogadat, griezelig slim is de Nederlandse versie. Scary Smart heet het in het Engels. En check ook vooral zijn eerste boek. Het is vaak genoemd, het is met dat smiley op de voorkant, weet je wel. A Soul for Happy, oftewel de logica van geluk. Thank you so much, Mo, for
Thank
your time.
You for having me. That was a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
Ik hoop dat je het leuk vond. Ik weet niet of ik het vaker ga doen in het Engels, maar ik vond het zeker top. Want het heeft me heel veel informatie gegeven. Laat eventjes een bericht achter in de comments. Or maybe I should do this in English as well because of the English viewers, listeners, I don't know. But leave a comment then. En graag tot de volgende. Fijne dag.
Hoi.
Dankjewel voor het luisteren. Leuk dat je het hele gesprek gecheckt hebt. En ik kom hier dan toch nog even binnenvallen om een kleine reminder te doen. Niet pushy, relaxed. In stilte. Nou, niet in stilte, want ik praat. Maar heb je jezelf al aangemeld? Ja. Koekeroe.nl/meditatie. Anders kan je dat nu doen. Koekeroe, dat is koekeroe.nl/meditatie. Meditatie met een i, want dat is wat we gaan doen. Van 1 tot 10 mei. En het is helemaal gratis, hè, het live kijken. Koekeroe.nl/meditatie.